West. For instance, one of the statements I made was, and I hope you notice that I said, if we are to bring Alaska gas to the Midwest, we must have an Alaska-Canadian gas line to the Midwest as soon as possible. Alaska gas in the Midwest would relieve the pressures in that area and make portions of the oil currently consumed by the industry in the Midwest available to help them meet the needs in Oklahoma. I answered the question several times for a period of from July 9th through July 13th. I faced that question several times. I once said if the Trans-Alaska line, the oil line, is operational by 1977, a natural gas pipeline across Canada can be feeding clean fuel to Midwestern homes and factories by 1980. That was the time frame we faced at that time. There was no commitment to Midwestern senators, but I'd say to you very, very candidly, we would not have an oil pipeline and we would not be facing the question of a gas pipeline if we had not had the support of the people who voted for the pipeline, the oil pipeline, because they felt it would clear the way for a Canadian gas pipeline to bring gas from Prudhoe Bay to the Midwest. And this was most effectively pointed out to them by the people that were involved in that gas pipeline system. Incidentally, there were, from that same area, 8 Republicans who opposed the Trans-Alaska oil pipeline and 22 Democrats who opposed it. It was a political issue in a sense. As I pointed out, we had 28 out of 43, and the Democrats had 21 out of 57 who supported the pipeline. And naturally, if the question of commitment comes up, I think it logically comes to my shoulders. I made no commitment, but I think that without their feeling that they would have gas sooner with an oil pipeline built through Alaska, we would not have had the oil pipeline. And it's something we now must face. And I mentioned 22 of these people, all of whom have voted for the oil pipeline, are now supporting the resolution that's before the Congress to require early approval of the Trans-Canadian gas pipeline to bring gas to the Midwest. The gas shortage in the Midwest and in the Pennsylvania and Maryland area is the most acute in the country. And I think it's a legitimate comment that Bob has made. I made no commitments, but I do think that they voted for the oil pipeline on the basis of their understanding that if the oil pipeline were built, they would have a Canadian gas pipeline.
One more question.
On what?
I'm getting to that. Would you consider it political suicide in Alaska to wholeheartedly support the Arctic gas pipeline?
Obviously. I'd like to, you want to give me 2 minutes to elaborate on that? I want to point out to you the changes that are in the Congress now. We face a Senate that has an entirely new group, 13 new senators. They're primarily from the areas that are, in fact, involved in the Trans-Canada pipeline support. And I would invite you to take a look at the maps that will appear in the papers and on television and see where those new senators are from. To my knowledge, there's not one of those new senators that will support a Trans-Alaska gas pipeline. And again, I tell you, I consider him one of my great friends. I think he's still a great friend of Alaska, and that's Senator Jackson, a very viable, potential Democratic candidate for the presidency, who is the only one who's articulating, besides me, the two-pipeline concept. And we joined together to get $69 million to assure the early exploration of PET4 primarily for gas. And if it's there, we'll have the two pipelines, and both of these people will be building pipelines in this period of time we're talking about. And again, I say we'll do that only if our Canadian neighbors still believe in us after this debate's over.
Frank, with that, you can hand it back.
Well, we'll keep the panelists on their feet. Here's a question for Bob Ward. Would you speculate on the economic effects of financing the Arctic gas proposal? Where will the money come from? What will happen in the national competition for financing, and what might happen to interest rates? It sounded like it came from a banker, Bob.
Okay. As far as the financial package of Arctic gas is concerned, as you're all aware, in Canadian law, any pipeline in Canada is required by Canadian law to be 51% owned by Canadians. What this means in our system is that our financial plan now is presently predicated on 25% equity and 75% debt. Of that 25% equity, the 51% of it, at least, has to come from Canada. Now, we've felt in our financial planning that maybe as much as 60% could come from the Canadian capital markets. We're all aware, I'm sure, that the energy problem that faces us demands fantastic capital requirements. And beyond the 51% equity ownership required in Canada, and Canada will waive that under certain circumstances. We are not asking them to do so because we feel it's an advantage to our project that's capital intensive anyway to have the maximum amount of Canadian participation in the equity ownership that's possible just to get the money. In addition to that, we'll rely heavily on the Canadian banking system for their capacity. We don't see any problem in the U.S. banking system for capacity for interim financing during construction until the long-term monies are in place to get the project going. And we still feel that the bulk of the financing will come from the United States capital markets with the maximum requirement that's possible under not only under Canadian law, but by practicality from Canada for that equity portion of it. So that any project's going to be a strain on capital markets. We have not said that we would need federal government assistance to finance the project. It is possible, and it would be helpful, if the posture in the federal government was such that it would make private commitments to our project financially attractive to them. In other words, and in condition of that, of course, is that the pipeline itself would have to have a tariff based on cost of service, which would require a continuous revenue flow, even in the event of force majeure, which would be events that were beyond the acts of God, whether they be political or otherwise, and regardless of what happens to the pipeline, the revenue will have to flow to satisfy the debt service. So government action in those areas could be helpful to us, approving a tariff, on all events tariff, take-or-pay tariff, and also, in some cases, allowing utility investors, of course, to roll their investments into their rate base in terms of earning on the rate base of monies that they made available to us. That's a rather complicated topic, but there's capacity in the financial markets in the two countries, we're convinced.
We'll run through these quickly. General Bennett, you mentioned the fact, I believe, that liquefaction plants have been exempt from taxation. That is taxation by the state only. Local entities can tax such plants, but not if they're in Canada. I guess that wasn't you. That must have been you, Bob. I'll give it to you later. Why don't you take a peek at that? And
Is that for me?
It appears to be at the end, yeah. Here's one, John. In the 5 million plus acres of potential agriculture land in interior Alaska, are these being considered as a market for North Slope gas products?
I know that they're considered as a great potential use for the feedstocks and natural gas coming through this area. Again, that's the state's problem. The potential here for manufacturing cheap fertilizer here in the Tananaw Valley is sort of mind-boggling. If you bring 4 million acres under cultivation, it makes the Matanuska Valley look like a victory garden in the backyard. And it obviously is the rarest commodity of the petrochemicals today. This fall, there's not sufficient fertilizer at any price to put the fall crop in the Midwest of the United States. So if there's ever going to be cheap fertilizer here, it seems to me it'll come here through the economics of a large-diameter pipeline that the state can make available for that type of industry, just as we have it down in the Kenai. I might say, when the gas is brought to Fairbanks, it's very important to be sure what the price of the gas is going to be. And I am delighted, Bob, as an Alaskan, to hear that it's economically feasible to bring that small quantity of gas to Fairbanks. But it's a legitimate question, what will the price be? Because if it's 5 times the price out of a large diameter line, we're going to have more difficulty attracting people here to buy it and use it.
Same price. 218 million cubic feet a day ain't small.
I would like to be sure I understand this, because I want to make sure that I heard this. It is feasible to take only the Alaska royalty gas by pipeline to Fairbanks, and it will be sold at the same price as out of a 42-inch diameter line. Is that correct, Bob? I just want to be sure I understand it, because it's an important statement. Is that right?
Okay. John, I'm sure that you're acknowledging the fact that we're going to serve the pipeline pumping stations as we come down.
Fine.
I mean, it's all a total package.
We'll ask the two gentlemen to take out their pencils, because we've got a mathematician in the audience that states we have the market. Royalty gas stated at 218 million cubic feet a day. Alaska pumped stations at Phase 3 mode of operations would utilize 100 million cubic feet per day. Generating stations now converted plus new units to come on by 1980 capable of using 70 million cubic feet per day. Other commercial and industrial, 20 million, so 190 million market, which with no domestic use considered. Any comments, gentlemen, on the utilization of that gas?
That sounds like a friend of mine with whom I've worked before, and any time we can do that again, Robert, why?
He recognized the handwriting.
Yeah.
Okay. Here's one for Senator Stevens. Does it really make any difference what we Alaskans think about gas line proposals? Isn't the decision going to be made in Washington, D.C. anyway? Aren't we going to build both anyway? We've heard your comments on both, but how about the decision being made in Washington?
The decision, we will have an impact on the decision. We will not make the decision. It will finally be made in the Congress, I think. And the question really is as to whether we approach that decision in the proper, proper way as to whether we will have a perceptible impact on the final decision. I think we can and will have a very perceptible impact on the final decision. We will face the question of whether the FPC in the first instance picks El Paso over Arctic or Arctic over El Paso. I think the chances of Alaska trying to upset an FPC decision are nil. On the other hand, I think the chances of the people who support the Arctic gas line being able to upset an FPC decision in favor of the Alaska pipeline are substantial unless we approach it in the proper way. So I would say that, that's a long-range answer to say, yes, we can have an impact on it. I've been outspoken about El Paso's approach in the past, and I think equally outspoken about Arctic's approach in the past. And I don't. There's one thing that hasn't been raised here yet, and it's a little embarrassing to my good friend John Bennett, both as general and as his positions in the government in Washington. But let me point out to you one of the factors that's going to have a great deal to do with this final decision, in my opinion, is that El Paso, as he points out, has the largest distribution system in the country today. If they have Alaska's gas, they become the greatest monopoly in the country as far as natural gas is concerned. The antitrust aspects of it, as far as the people who oppose the Trans-Alaska gas pipeline system, are going to weigh very heavily with the Congress, and I think we've got an uphill route to support the Trans-Alaska system. We will benefit more by the two-pipeline approach and by the hope that we'll have by 1980 when these gas pipelines are completed, enough gas to fill them both.
Could I respond?
General, please.
I want to be sure, Senator Stevens, that you didn't understand what I said. I said we transmitted more gas last year than any other company. There are larger transmission companies in terms of length of pipeline and so on. Also, I want to remind you that we are not building 1 foot of pipe in the lower 48, so we're not expanding what is a long way from the largest system. I just want to be sure the facts are straight. It's the amount of gas we transmit. We're not, by any stretch of the imagination, the largest transmission company in the business.
Well, John, you've got to admit, though, that your company has been in the Supreme Court repeatedly over antitrust implications in the past, and this one's going to lead us into litigation if you're involved in this one. That's one of the reasons I've been asking for someone else to come in for the Alaska line, and I think we're going to have to find someone else to get in the Alaska line ultimately, because I firmly believe the antitrust implications of El Paso's involvement in this line are going to lead to litigation, as they did when El Paso went from into the Pacific Northwest and finally was forced to divest itself of that line because of the antitrust implications.
There's no question that our company divested itself of a company in the Northwest, and we were ordered to do it, and we did it. I also think it's worth saying that any regulated company spends a great deal of time in court. We're in court on several cases now. And as an Alaskan, I would like to say that if another group is coming in, I hope they come quickly, because there's a lot of time and a lot of expertise to be made up if we're not going to have a slippage of several years. I think it's very important that anyone else that can do the job better come in right away, because there's always a lot of slippage to be made up. I think you'll agree with that, Ted.
Yes.
While you're on your feet, General, there's a couple of more quick ones. How do you propose to divide the tariff for the transportation of gas between Prudhoe and Fairbanks as compared between Prudhoe and Tidewater?
I cannot answer that. That's basically a decision for the state. There's already been a few public statements from people out of Chuck's office, but I'm not able to answer how that tariff will be divided.
Next question. We might as well. You're awful anxious to sit down, but I'm going to get this one, too. Can you guarantee that the state of Alaska will be permitted to withdraw its royalty share of the methane fraction of the gas in your pipeline? If you cannot guarantee this, what assistance do you propose to give the state of Alaska against adverse FPC ruling in this regard.
Nobody can guarantee that subject because it has to be ruled on by the federal government and the Federal Power Commission. We have already, with our law firm and the law firm retained by the state of Alaska, exchanged legal briefs on this, and I want Commissioner Herbert to have a chance to confirm or deny this. Both of these firms, and they're two of the most prestigious and able firms in Washington, now say, one to the state and the other to us, that they are highly confident that they can get a ruling that the ownership of this gas in this line could be guaranteed to the state of Alaska. But there's no way to say any more than that. It has to be decided by the FPC.
Chuck, Commissioner Herbert, do you want to comment on that?
Well, yes, of course, that is a question that's bothered the state very much from the very beginning as we've made a research of what the Natural Gas Act might mean in that regard. And we have employed, as John has said, one of the most prestigious law firms in Washington, D.C., who have experts that have worked with the Federal Power Commission most of their lives. They are still working on it, but they think that they can come up with something. And as was mentioned by our director of the Division of Oil and Gas, I believe, here in Fairbanks some time ago, if we should fail everything else, there is still the possibility of writing an underlift agreement into the operation of the Prudhoe Bay field. Now, an underlift agreement, as Senator Stevens brought up earlier, has its drawbacks, all right, but it is a possible manner, way in which the state could maintain its gas underground until such time as it was ready to use it, whether it be through a separate line or something else like that.
Chuck, while you're on your feet, here's another one for you. What does the federal government and the state government see as the future of Petroleum Reserve Number 4 in the next 10 years? Is it politically possible to develop it privately? Would a portion of its resources remain as a military reserve? That's both a state and federal question.
Well, just recently, the Secretary of the Interior wrote to Congressman Haley, chairman of the House Resources Committee, urging that the PET-4 be transferred over to the Department of the Interior with certain strings attached, that it would be operated as an energy reserve, that there would be no distribution of any of the royalties or bonuses to the state, that state selections within this reserve and native selections would be prohibited. That's the most recent development on that. I'm afraid if the question meant has the state of Alaska and the Department of the Interior come to any agreement, the answer is no.
You want to comment on this?
From the federal side, what the Secretary is trying to do with his new hat as an energy coordinator for the federal government is to try and convert the Naval Petroleum Reserves. That wasn't just a bill that applied to Alaska, as you know, Chuck. It applied to all naval reserves, to convert those into national petroleum reserves as opposed to naval petroleum reserves. So those lands are not available for state and native selection now. They would not be available if the status was changed. We've been trying to get a portion of the return for Alaska, and we've not been successful so far. But as a practical matter, from the point of view of the oil in PET-4, utilization of that as a national reserve would be impossible without another pipeline. The Alaska oil pipeline has no reserve capacity. From the point of view of the gas in PET-4, it is possible with both pipelines that are proposed to use the gas in the period of time we're talking about. So I think that the Interior's proposal to try and make that gas available for use would be a viable one for us. What we've got to do is work out some way so the state would be able to participate in a return from that resource that's within the state. No state has ever participated in any return from any Naval Petroleum Reserve, so it's a very difficult proposition we face in the future.
I'd like to add one more.
Commissioner?
To be frank, when we're talking about Federal Reserves, of course, one of the things that's dear to my heart, or bothers me, I should say, rather than being dear to my heart, is the fact that one of the highest potential for both oil and gas on the North Slope lies in the northwest corner of the Arctic Wildlife Range, which the Secretary could open for leasing tomorrow. It has the greatest potential right now for early development. The PET-4, of course, is still being studied. There are various places to drill. Unquestionably, it will develop a lot of oil and a lot of gas. But there's one anticline, the Marsh Creek anticline, some 42 miles long, that's already mapped and could be developed rather readily. However, it is within the Arctic Wildlife Range.
Senator, you don't care to respond to that.
Well, the problem is the Arctic Wildlife Range is now the Arctic Wildlife Refuge. And the question is whether we want to face the environmental litigation that would be involved in opening that as compared to the other lands. And if Chuck's tossed me a nice fireball, let me toss it back. The state has 105, 103.5 million acres. The native people have 40 million acres. If either of these reserves are opened up that are got the stamp of approval of the federal government and the research that's been done, the native lands are almost valueless, and the 103.5 million acres, of which you have under lease, to my knowledge, of less than 10 million, would also be valueless. I've taken the position that the native lands and the Alaska state lands should be developed first, and that the reserves that are there will eventually produce the Arctic Wildlife Range or refuge, will eventually produce the Naval Petroleum Reserve number 4. To do so now would delay the development of the lands that have been given to the natives and the lands that have been given to the state. I don't think that that's the economically wise course to take at this juncture, particularly when you've got, as far as the state is concerned, a gap between what's left of the $900 million and the beginning of the income from the oil pipeline, which is almost 5 years long. In that period of time, we should be leasing the state lands. The native people should be leasing their lands, from which the state will get considerable income tax return. We would get no return under existing law from either the Arctic Wildlife Refuge or PET 4. By the time the state lands and the native lands have been produced, by the time Prudhoe Bay is produced, when we have to produce those reserves in the national interest, I think that the national government will recognize the interest of the state for a legitimate portion of the return from those from the production in those areas. Now, that's been my position, my old friend. I thank you for the opportunity.
Well, you're still on your feet, Senator. You've said there's two deficiencies in the two proposals to the Federal Power Commission, in your opinion. Are you satisfied with El Paso's commitment to provide a gas tap anywhere the state wants? Or does that commitment not go far enough in protecting Alaska's interests? If not, why not?
Well, I don't think it means a damn thing, frankly. You can put a tap anywhere you want. To have the right to take the gas out of it once it's committed to an interstate pipeline under the FPC is a different matter. And I have tried to get El Paso, and I would support El Paso, if it would bend its pipeline and take it through Fairbanks. It's not going to come through Fairbanks instead. It comes awful near. Let's not take it through Fairbanks and down the Alaska Railroad right away. It could provide service all the way through the rail belt. You could put taps there that we could utilize today, and not only my good friend here from the REA here, but believe me, the REAs down there would like to have an opportunity to get that gas. And the Matanuska Valley, I'm not talking about Anchorage, I'm talking about the Matanuska Valley, north of the Neck Arm, has the only land that's in state ownership that's entirely available for us for industrial development. We could offer the petrochemical companies, agrochemical companies, state land. We could offer to build spurs from the railroad. We could offer to build docks on the north side of the Cook Inlet for them. We could then have a viable position to attract this industry we're talking about. We can't do it with their proposal because you know where they're going? They're going to the Forest Service land. They're going to take that down to Gravina Point where there is no land available. And I've got a map right here. If you'd like to look at the map, the land that's available in that area, there is none. And we'll have very little chance of getting any land out of the Forest Service for industrial development if we go to Gravina Point. But it's entirely possible that the El Paso line could be entirely compatible with Alaska's interest. And we wouldn't be worrying about this question of building a pipeline up to Fairbanks and down through the rail belt to Anchorage, to that Cook Inlet area. If we'd only have an opportunity to have an impact on that decision, I think we might win it all together. Because if the petrochemical companies that have come to talk to me, and we've talked to some of the same ones, Chuck, they want land first. They've got to have land of substantial amounts to deal with the industrial development that they're talking about, and they do not see it coming from the Forest Service.
Please go ahead, John.
Here's a picture, which you might want, of the largest inland petrochemical installation in the United States. It occupies 800 acres. It includes not only natural gas, LPGs, it includes a synthetic rubber plant, it includes a huge Shell refinery. It occupies 800 acres. We have reserved 1,200, Senator Stevens. There is a minimum of 300 adjacent acres that are perfectly good for construction in the location that we're in. So I don't understand the paucity of land. I also am not too sure that people who live in Big Delta, Gokana, Copper River, down toward Valdez are as enthusiastic as you are about following the rail belt down. I also know that the environmental concern of going down a different corridor which has to be justified under the Mineral Leasing Act, would cause a delay in putting in this first pipeline. And I will remind you that the tides in Cook Inlet are 30 feet, opposed to 7 feet in Prince William Sound. The ice conditions are very bad. We're having trouble with these two little LNG tankers right now that don't come in once a day and are half the size of these others. From a maritime standpoint, it's almost impossible to put in an LNG terminal, which we have to do to get 7/8 of this gas to market. I just say that is the other side of the question.
Want to continue the debate?
Sure, go ahead.
That's the very area where today the Collier Chemical Plant is being doubled in size, as I pointed out. The barges are coming in there. The LNG tankers are coming in there. That's the area, again, where we have the only control over the situation. You may have 1,200 acres down there reserved. You don't have the title to them. We won't get the title to them except within 2 miles of the city of Cordova, and I understand Cordova's desire to have this system go to their area. At least a majority of their people do, I assume. But if we're going to have any control over the utilization of the gas, it will only be if we can take it to Alaska state lands. And that, I think, is the complete... I don't really buy this business that the tides in Cook Inlet are any factor in the decision to use that area. And I don't think anyone has explored with the Department of Interior the environmental considerations. My talks with the railroad people and with the Department of Interior indicate that they'd be willing to consider the proposition of using the Alaska Railroad right-of-way, which already is a federal right-of-way. It is wide enough to take a gas pipeline in it, and there would be no real difficulty, again, environmentally, in my opinion. It doesn't involve the same environmental considerations. As Bob pointed out, if you're going in and out of the pipeline right-of-way and going into a new area down into Gravina Point. I still don't know whether the environmentalists are going to accept that. Remember, this is the area where for 5 years now, more than that, gosh, it's since 1964, they've opposed the rebuilding of the Copper River Highway. And yet we're expected to see them completely accept the concept of an entirely new industrial system going down into that area, which they say is the area that comes first as far as Alaska is concerned in terms of the need for environmental protection. Excuse me.
We told you we'd have you out here by 3 o'clock. There's just a couple of more questions. Senator Stevens, one of the questions that we've discussed seems to be how to utilize on an economic basis a portion of the gas in interior Alaska. The railroad extension were built south of the Canadian transcontinental system, offering an outlet to the United States transcontinental railroad system. Would this concept offer a market in Alaska for utilization of this gas in the form of petrochemicals? And if so, couldn't the state possibly participate in the railroad? We operate a ferry system.
My answer is yes. Yes, I think that's a feasible thing. We've discussed it before with the state, and I've put some reservations in some of this national transportation legislation that gives the state an option to extend railroads if they want to. We're discussing now with the BC government the extension of their line up to the Canadian border, and we have a study going on of the extension of the Alaska Railroad, as you all know, to the Canadian border. It's entirely feasible that we could export in that fashion. However, I think it's more feasible to expect that we'll be exporting our hard rock mineral resources in that manner than to think that in the immediate future we'll be dealing with the petrochemical or agrochemical concepts. Most of those use tidewater locations and involve transportation by barges. But I think it is feasible to look to the extension of the railroad as producing a new industrial development in this area.
There's three more quick ones. Bob, this is your last one. You mentioned that the fact that liquefaction plants have been exempt from taxation. That is taxation by the state only. Local entities can tax such plants, but not if they're in Canada. Comment.
I've almost forgotten how to talk, Frank. The only reason that I mentioned that was because of a tax attorney in the state that was looking at the comparison taxation and then looking at the El Paso filing and the combination of the special legislation, the special session of the legislature and the legislation that exempted liquefaction plants, it's a kind of a gray area now. There's not much question in my mind that facilities will be taxed. However, Gravina Point's not in a political subdivision. There's not other than the state general taxation powers, there's no local political subdivision there. And right now it looks like the law exempts liquefaction plants. That's the only reason I pointed to that.
Thank you. This is for both General Bennett and Bob Ward. The Canadian Native Claims Act may require partial native ownership of the proposed Gas Arctic line. Will your company support this concept for your own lines? I think Bob is probably...
Well, in terms of equity ownership and the type of the project we're financing, we're not in the posture yet, haven't been, I wouldn't think that we would be, to deny anyone acquiring equity ownership if they wanted to invest in the line.
Would you care to comment on that, General?
Same.
Same answer. And this is the last question to the podium. and Mr. Bob Ward and General Bennett. Which company can supply natural gas to Fairbanks in the shortest possible time?
You want to leave now?
Rather than answer that, gentlemen, would you care to?
Well, I think that I think the timing of the projects is pretty much incidental, the same basic time frame.
Well, this asks for a date, see. I didn't want anything general. I think that concludes.